Hi, everybody, and it's me again. I'm going to be sharing with you today, be giving the talk, and over the next few weeks, actually, throughout September, I'll be with you. So I've got the next 3 weeks, and then I'll take a break, and then I got the fifth week in September, and then Justin is back. And we're looking forward to him coming back. For those that don't know, our lead pastor is on sabbatical, and so he returns in October. And so until then, you've got me for the last remainder bit, and I'm excited to be with you as we continue on this conversation. We've been looking at the Hall of Faith, and over the past month, we've been going through character studies, and most of those who have been sharing and teaching over the past 4 weeks have been focusing on Hebrews 11, and that makes sense, because if you're familiar with your Bibles, Hebrews 11 is a popular chapter where it highlights characters in the Old Testament that had great faith of some kind, and they're talked about as something that is to be admired and to look at their faith. And so we've been doing these deep dives in these characters, and I'm going to be talking about David, but we're going to do a bunch of setup before we get into David. So we're going to look at a bunch of things before we get into David. And one of the things that stands out to me is that as we've all been looking at these character studies over the past few weeks, we've been kind of working through Hebrews 11. And the point of this conversation that we're having, this series that we're having, is to look at all types of characters and their walk with God and what we can learn from. And so you'll find out next week, I'm going to talk about Esther, and the following week, I'm going to talk about Ruth, neither of whom are mentioned in this Hebrews 11. And so it's not that we're necessarily walking through Hebrews 11, even though the previous sermons have done some of that. The point is to look at these characters and try to learn from them and what they've done, and so what we can pull out for us today. And so I kind of want to do something first. I want to set up here this idea of when we look at characters in the Bible, how should we think of these people? Okay, so it's easy for us to look at Abraham, Moses, David, Samuel, all these different characters that we read about in Scripture. How should we think about them? And to help us wrap our minds around how we should think about these people, we are going to play a little game together, okay? You're going to play a game with me. This game that we're going to play this morning is called Good Guy, Bad Guy. Good guy, bad guy. We're going to look at three characters in the Bible, and we're going to ask the question, are they a good guy or are they a bad guy? And what makes them who they are? And so we got three characters we're going to look at, and so we're going to begin looking at our first character. The first character is Abraham. We're going to ask the question, is Abraham a good guy or a bad guy? I think that picture is Abraham there. That's the best picture I could get for Abraham. So we all know that that's him. But we're looking at Abraham here. Is Abraham a good guy or a bad guy? Well, let's look at the story of Abraham. There's a few things that we can pull out. We can look at things like when God called him to leave, he said, leave your father's household, leave your family, and go to a place I'm going to show you. And you go ahead and show this first setup here. So he left his family to follow God. Okay, that's a pretty good thing. He fought to save his family from destruction when his nephew was going to be a part of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. He debated with God, and he convinced God to help get him out of there. All right, so that's a pretty good thing. He treats people fairly. If you remember the story of his nephew Lot, when they had to divide the land, he said, "You pick what you want. You take the best, and I'll take whatever." So he's like giving preferential treatment to his nephew. That's a pretty good thing. He's treating people fairly. He's a great host when the angels come to visit Abraham. He puts on a big meal for them and takes care of them, and so he's a great host. So these are good things that we can see in him. Well, what else do we see in Abraham? Well, we see the other side of Abraham. He doesn't listen well, okay? Well, when God says, leave your father's household, leave your family behind, and go to a place I'm going to show you, who does he take with him? His nephew. Okay, so he's not really, he's obeying, but he's kind of not really fully listening to what God asked him to do. He's a liar. Okay, so when he's scared, he lies to the Egyptians about who his wife is, so that because he's afraid that they're going to kill him over her. So he's lying to them. He lacks an ability to be honest. He doesn't trust. He doesn't trust Abraham when he was told the promise that he's going to have lots of kids through him. His family's going to bless the nation. And he takes matters into his own hands with Hagar. And so he's trying to kind of force the story and the narrative ahead of God, what God's timing was. So he's not really trusting very well. He manipulates. And so we see these sides of Abraham, and we ask the question, is he a good guy or a bad guy? Hard to tell. Okay, let's look at someone else then. He's hard to tell. Let's look at someone else. Jacob. Let's look at Jacob. This is what Jacob looks like in his prime. Jacob, we got to ask the question, is Jacob a good guy or is he a bad guy in the story? And so let's look at some of the things that might be good. Well, he wants to have God's blessing. That's a good thing, right? He desires to have God's blessing. He's a hard worker. Remember the story where he was tricked about who he's going to marry, and he ends up working another 7 years to marry the woman he wanted. So he's a determined hard worker. He loves his mama, all right? There's no more true sign of a good guy than of mama's boy, all right? So he follows when mom says do this, he goes and does it. So he loves his mom, and he loves his sons, right? He's a good father. He has these sons who he cares for deeply, and one in particular he makes special clothing for. Like, he loves his son. That's a good thing. Jacob seems to be a good guy until you look at other things in his life. He's a cheater. Right, he's robbing the blessing from his brother. He's a manipulator and kind of works angles to his own advantage. He's not a really good brother or even a good son. He deceives his father by taking the blessing. He's a coward. Instead of owning up to what he had done, he ran away from his brother to hide. The coward, good guy, bad guy. Okay, still not very clear, right? So let's look at one more character in the Bible, King David. All right, we know King David. King David, he has to be the good guy. So let's look at things in his life. Well, he's a great warrior for God. He advances God's reign and rule and establishes a dynasty of kings. He loves God, right? There's the attribute of him that he's a man after God's own heart. He loves God. He's loyal, right? To the point where when Saul is king and he's waiting to be king, he doesn't just get rid of the king. He stays loyal to what Saul as the king. So he's loyal in that way. He's a good friend. Jonathan, his best friend, he was a good friend to Jonathan. And so he seems like a pretty good guy. King David, good guy. Well, there's more to his story, isn't there? He's a murderer. Okay, in orchestrating the murder, he's lazy. There's a story of when the kings go off to war, David stayed behind in his palace. All right, supposed to be going off and doing king things, but he's kind of being a little lazy in that story. He's adulterous. He's a manipulator. So even with King David, good guy, bad guy, and that's the point. Okay. That's the point of all of these characters. We look at and we want to go, good guy, we should model. And then we read their lives and go, oh, actually, kind of a bad guy too. It's unclear, good guy, bad guy. You see, the point is that it's complicated. The point is that life is complicated. Humans are complicated. God knows this, and he's okay with it. Because the story of the Bible is about a God who's advancing his story and chooses to use complicated humans along the way. Good guy, bad guy. That's not the point. The point is that God is stepping in to use people, despite where they're at, for his purpose and his kingdom. Let's explain, look at this a little bit further. But I want to highlight for you Hebrews 11. So when we think of Hebrews 11 and this like outpouring of names of their faith, this is like my Bible commentary of what Hebrews 11 is about. God's faithfulness, not the perfection of heroes. It showcases, this entire chapter showcases how he used flawed, ordinary people to carry out his redemptive plan. This chapter, Hebrews 11, reminds us that faith is about trusting in God's power rather than relying on human perfection, as he accomplishes his purpose through imperfect individuals. Okay, so that's a lot, right? That's in your notes, if you grabbed your notes in there, so you'll have that to reflect on. This is what Hebrews 11 is about. Hebrews 11 isn't about showcasing all these great people. It's actually about showcasing how great God is in his faithfulness in light of all the full scope of the narrative of these people. God's faithful over and over and over again to step into history to work out his redemptive plan, his rescue of this broken world. What do I mean by that? I want to give you an illustration here. We're going to talk about the Bible from like a 30,000 foot view. I've used this illustration in the past when I've given a teaching here about the Bible. It's an illustration that I made to help. It's not the best Bible overview illustration in history, right? There's probably better than this. But this is my version of, if you were to say, what is the Bible about? It's this. There's a QR code up on the screen. It's also in your notes. You can scan this and it'll actually give you a PDF readout for your own purposes that you can hold on to and do whatever you want with. But this is a basic overview of the Bible. You can divide the Bible into three different acts, right? Think of a play, three different acts. And within each act, there are three basic scenes at play. And so when you're thinking about the Bible as a whole, act one is all about the beginning, when God created everything and it was good and it was perfect. And then not too long after that, right? It fails in that the humans fail to actually work in relationship with God in that good reality. So you have the fall. Then the fall goes from chapter 3 all the way through chapter 11 of Genesis, where you get this downward spiral of humanity getting worse and worse and worse and worse. Story after story. There's one moment where God tries to hit the reset button with Noah, but then right after Noah, it goes right back down into that spiral path that it's on. And it goes all the way up to the point where you have the promise. So you go the beginning, the fall, the promise, where God steps back in with Abraham and he says, I'm going to make a promise with you that through we're going to work together. Your family is going to be the family by which I bless the rest of the earth. Your family is the family I'm going to bless the rest of the earth. And we're going to do this together, right? And so you have the promise. So that's act one, this grand arc that's happening here, moving from the beginning good, the fall, the promise. But then you move into the next step where you have the law, the rule, and the loss. And this is all about this idea where the people as this family, as they grow and they step into the reality through the rescue out of Egypt, into their place that God wants them to be, they are given a law, an ability to understand, how do we be the people of God on God's earth? If you've called us, how do we do that? And so the law comes into play. And then you have the rule where that moves into a dynasty of kings that are helping the people know how to actually, their job is to help people live this thing out, right? To help bring oversight to being the people that God desires. Does that work out well? No. Again, we have another fall-like scenario where we have an exile. And so then you have the loss of the promised land, the loss of the temple. This is a great loss in the story of Israel. And even though they have a return back, they are a shadow of what they were at the height of the rule and the dynasty. They do return, but they're a shadow. And they're awaiting someone to become a priestly king that will come and lead them out of this state that they find themselves in of oppression and being ruled over by the Assyrians, the Babylonians, and then the Greeks, and then then Rome. And so you have all of this stuff, and they're waiting for a priestly king to come and bring deliverance and establish them back into their place that God had promised way back with Abraham. And this is where we move into, we have the image. And so we have these four gospels that give us an image of what it looks like to be God's people on God's earth. Jesus models for us so that we can model through him to the rest of the world what it looks like to be God's people. So you have the image, the what it's supposed to look like. We look at Jesus. We ask, how do you do this? We look at Jesus. He is the image that we follow after. Then you have the way. Okay, so then you have the church trying to live this thing out, this Jesus movement, trying to do that. And then that goes all the way through from Acts all the way up until into Revelation. And then you have the return, Revelation 21, where God finally comes down. And read Revelation 21 and ask yourself the question, do we go up or does God come down? Right? So this notion that we have that, like, I'm just waiting to get out of here. Hold on, read Revelation 21 because it sounds like God comes here. And his kingdom comes here. And God comes to dwell with us. And so there's a reality coming our way where God will actually be here with us and his rule and reign. It's a return back to the beginning. It's almost like Revelation 21 is a new Genesis that's taking place, where God returns us back to what he originally planned. You see, when God set everything up in Genesis 1 and then the fall happens in Genesis 3, it's not like God goes, well, I guess I'm just done with all this. We're going to do something else entirely different. No. The story of the Bible is about God saying, what I called good is still good. What I called good, I wasn't lying. I'm not just going to go scrap it. Let's do something else. It's like, no, I will make this good. And so the story of the Bible is about a God who continually jumps into history to align, redirect, and move his story forward. And what is his story? To return as Lord of everything here on earth, where there'll be no more sickness, no more death, no more crying, no more weeping. The sea will be no more. Well, what does that mean? Why? There's not going to be any water? Can I not go to the beach in God's kingdom? No. The sea was a metaphor for chaos in the Hebrew culture. And so this was an idea of, like, in Genesis 1, where was God's spirit? It was hovering over the watery abyss. It's a non-ordered, chaotic state. So when in Revelation 21 it says that there'll be no sea, it means that God will remove any disorder and only his perfect rule and order will remain, because there will be no disorder, dysfunction. There'll be no more sea. So this is the story of the Bible, God. So the Bible, here's the thing about this. The Bible's not about you. And we do this sometimes with the Bible. We make it about me. The Bible becomes a how-to book. How do I stop sinning? How do I have joy? How do I have hope? How do I do these things? I'm feeling sad today. What verses are going to cheer me up? Is that a bad thing to do? No. Okay, hear me out, y'all. But when we live in that space too long, we actually begin to treat the Bible as if it's about me. When the true nature of the Bible is that it's telling the story of God and his faithfulness to bring us back to a point where we can be in relationship with him forever. The story of the Bible is a story about God. And so when we get to Hebrews 11 and we read this long list of names of people that had faith, we're actually being invited to see how faithful God is throughout history to move creation to a place where it is good once again. This is what Hebrews is about. It's about trusting God's story as if it's happening no matter what. Hebrews 11 invites us to trust God's story as if it's happening no matter what. What do I mean by that? Well, in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 20, there's a triad statement that's spoken by the author, and it goes like this. 11:20-22. By faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau regarding their future. Verse 21, by faith, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of Joseph's sons and worshiped as he leaned on top of his staff. Verse 22, by faith, Joseph, when his end was near, spoke about the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt and gave instructions concerning the burial of his bones. So in this triad statement here, we see this beautiful picture. The first thing that we notice is that the by faith beginning, by faith, by faith, by faith. And the whole chapter is littered with this by faith statement. And in here, we have the same thing. So what is this connecting word? What does it mean to have faith? Well, okay, lucky for us, the Hebrew author says, let me tell you, in the beginning of the chapter, 11, verse 1, he gives us the definition of faith. This is according to the NET. He says, or the translation NET, he says, so faith is confidence and what we hope for, and confidence about what we do not see. So there's this two-part thing at play: confidence in what we hope for, confidence in what we do not see. And if you were to try to boil down this word, faith, into one word, what would that word be? In my opinion, that word would be trust. Trust. Do we trust what God is doing now, what God's work is happening now, and do I trust that he will continue to do so in the future? So as we look back at that three-verse triad that we see here, all of these are about a faith, a trust in now, but also a trust in the future. He blessed his sons. Why does he bless his sons? Because he believes that God's continuing the story even though he's about to die. Why does Joseph send his bones to Egypt if he didn't trust, like he knew the story of God? So he said, look, this is not how the story ends. We don't end here in Egypt. So when I die, take my bones, take them with you, because God's moving the story forward. God is moving the story forward. He's using us to move it forward. But this is God's story to bring good back to the earth. The core message of Hebrews 11 is to highlight individuals from Israel's history who God used to fulfill his redemptive plan for all humanity. Each of these people played a role in that story. And the Bible is an invitation to trust that God is still telling that story, and he wants to use you. The Bible is an invitation to see how God is moving throughout the story, and then begin to ask the question, how is God going to use me? Because all of these people, they took their turn at bat. And now it's your turn. You're up to play. What are you going to do? God's going to use you. What are you going to do? And so over the next 3 weeks, we're going to tie together three stories that play this narrative out. The first one today, David, is God is at work. We're going to talk about how God is at work. Then we're going to look at Esther, and we're going to talk about next week, God is at work through you. And then we're going to look at Ruth, and we're going to wrestle with the reality that God is at work through you in the details. So that's where we're heading over the next 3 weeks, and I hope that you don't miss the following two, because it'll tie in together really well. And how's that for an introduction to a sermon? I'm the worst. Okay, I promise we're not going to go much longer. Because we do got to talk about David. David, God is at work. Now, we're not going to do a deep dive. When others have, you know, we try to like tell all aspects of David's life, we're not going to do that this morning. I'm going to hone in on a couple areas that I think are valuable for this conversation about David's life. So hopefully you're familiar with his story on some level. If not, go ahead and jump into 1 Samuel. You'll get a lot of his life and what he was up to. But we're just going to look at a couple areas we're going to fly over. And the first place that we're going to fly over actually has nothing to do with David. All right? Now, you might come to expect that from me, all right? But it's important to the narrative arc of David, all right? And it actually begins in 1 Samuel chapter 8. Let's read the story. It says this: so all the elders of Israel gathered together and approached Samuel, who was the priest that was the connection between God and the people at this time. At this time, there are no kings. There's no kings. Okay? It's a set of priests that help Israel know what God's up to. And so all of Israel was in tribes at this point. And they all kind of worked together in their tribes, and Samuel was kind of the connecting piece to all of them. So they go to Samuel at Ramah, and they say, look, you're old, okay, which is not a nice way to start a conversation, and your sons don't follow your ways. So now appoint over us a king to lead us, just like all the other nations have. So the reality was is that in the priestly responsibilities, it was handed down generationally. So Samuel had kids. They were expected to be the next in line to be the priests, and they would have led. But they're recognizing, Samuel, your priests don't serve God. So we need something else. We need a king. We need a king just like everyone else that we're looking around us. They all have kings. Why don't we have a king? We should have a king. They have them. But this request displeased Samuel. for they said, give us a king to lead us. So Samuel prayed to the Lord, and the Lord said to Samuel, do everything the people requested of you, for it is not you that they have rejected, but it is me that they have rejected as their king. Interesting. What immediately this tells us is that this whole dynasty of kings was not a part of what God wanted. This isn't what God wanted. They didn't reject you, Samuel. They rejected me as their king. God was going to lead them, walk alongside them through this priestly responsibility, and they rejected God as their king. So it's interesting that when we reflect on this concept and this idea, we immediately get into Saul and the choosing of Saul to be king, who was the next guy in line. They chose Saul. Saul didn't work out very well. And God steps in at this point and chooses David. And a question we can ask ourselves is, how often does God wait before he gets involved in our decisions? How long does God wait before he chooses to get involved in our decisions? Okay, so they chose Saul. God just said, all right, here you go. And God was involved throughout Saul's story in different moments. So it wasn't like God just stepped out of the scene completely and said, all right, enough of you guys, right? He was still doing things, but they chose Saul. And until Saul messed up and got to a point where he wasn't going to be used by God, God steps in and says, now I'll choose the king. And he chooses David. Okay? So how long will God wait before he steps in to help us? Now, we can think of this in a negative. And oftentimes we do. Like, oh man, you know, sometimes God goes, you know, I'm going to let you make your mistakes, and then I'm going to come in and, you know, rebuke and love and bring you and restore you and show you, see how that didn't work out because of what you did? It could be a negative, but what if it's a positive? What if God actually wants us to make decisions? What if God actually wants us to take initiative in what's happening around us? And God's desire is to simply partner with us. You know, I talk to students quite often who are moving out of high school, and the questions that get asked a lot, or the things that they're wrestling with a lot, is like, what am I going to do with the rest of my life? And there are times where that question revolves around, like, what does God want me to do with the rest of my life, right? And it's a noble question, but I think the question's flawed. Because here's the thing. God gave us desire. He gave us interest. He gave us talents. He blessed us with things that he just wants us to use. My question isn't like, what does God want you to do? I think God's okay with whatever you decide to do with your life as a career and as a future, right? What we're talking about here. God just wants to be invited into the process, right? Whatever you do, God just wants to be a part of it. His interest is advancing the story through whatever you're up to. And so go and just do what excites you, what makes you happy. Go do that, because God put that inside of you, and he then wants to use you through that. So what if it's actually a positive that God wants us to take initiative? So what I think is interesting here is that the real issue isn't that they wanted a king. That wasn't the issue. It was that they failed to recognize they already had one. See the difference? The issue here in 1 Samuel 8 isn't that they wanted a king. It's that they didn't have an ability to see that they already had one. And this is a fundamental flaw in most of us. When we ask for these things from God and we try to pursue God, we fail to see that he's already at work. He's already doing something. We just don't have eyes to see it. What is God up to? Because God is at work. He is always at work. He is moving constantly in and throughout this world, with you, in spite of you, right? He's at work. The question isn't, is God doing something? He is doing something. That's the scope of the Bible. He's constantly moving forward. He's just looking for people to join him. When people come to me and they say, well, Joe, if you know God is so good and he's so righteous and all these things, then why are there this kind of pain and suffering in the world? Or why is there people starving and why are there parts in this world? And I say, yeah, that's a great question. It is a great question. And you know what? I bet you God's heart's broken too. Well, yeah, why doesn't he allow it to happen? I would argue he doesn't want it to happen. It's just that he's waiting for someone to lift their hand and say, I'll go. Because if we learn anything about the Bible, is that God always uses humans to work out his plan. Where do we see a story in the Bible where God, apart from another human being, steps into history and just makes it all happen and then steps out? Humans are always involved. So the question should be, God, if I see brokenness in the world, am I willing to step into that and bring your good? This is what the Bible is inviting us to do, because God is at work. And even in the story, before David even steps into the scene, he is at work in and through the world, bringing about David. So when David gets anointed as king, that's in 1 Samuel 16, when David gets anointed as king, so Saul's kind of fallen off the wagon. And so Samuel goes and finds that God says, hey, I got someone in waiting. We're gonna replace Saul. We're going to bring in a new guy. And so they go to find him, and there's this little shepherd boy off tending sheep, and Samuel walks into the field, and he has anoints him to be king. He basically is like inaugurating this David as king. But was he king yet? No. David was anointed to be king, called to be the king. He doesn't actually become king for 15 more years. The whole time he knows he's supposed to be the king, 15 years goes by before he actually becomes king. Before he becomes king. And all the while, David was in the wings to become king. 15 years, he waited on God's timing and not his own. He waited on God's timing. He knew that God was at work, even though the evidence of such a thing was dim. David didn't rush out as a young boy and go, hey, y'all, I've arrived. Samuel just anointed me. I'm still getting the oil out of my hair. Sorry about that. But I'm king now. I'm going to do my thing. God put me here. No. 15 years he waits, even though all the evidence of him being the king was pointing in the other direction. Why? Because Saul was trying to kill him the whole time, trying to get rid of him, trying to oust, he didn't want anything to do with David. And so there's this story, and this is where I'll end, the last touch point in David's life. I'll jump in before we wrap up. In 1 Samuel 24, there's a crazy story where David's on the run. Saul's been chasing him, trying to kill him, still waiting to be king, but he's trusting on God's timing. And the story goes that David's hiding out in a cave, and Saul and his army are circling, like go looking for him everywhere, and Saul needs a little bathroom break. So he goes into the cave, in 1 Samuel 24, you can read it, he goes into the cave to use the restroom, right? And he has no idea that David's in the cave already. And so he's off, hiding behind the rock. Here comes Saul, and all the men are like, here's your chance, David. Like, now's your chance. Let's just get rid of him. You'll become king, and we'll start this whole thing. And David sits there, and he creeps up behind him, and got his robe there, and he cuts off a corner of the robe, and he takes it back. And in this story, we see David had an opportunity to take his future in his own hands. But he chose not. He said, far be it from me. In fact, he felt conviction, it says, by even cutting off the corner of the robe. He felt convicted that he even did that much. David waited for God to bring about his good, his way. God was at work, and David trusted that even though I don't see it now, right? What is faith? It's trusting in what I hope for, which is that God will do what he said he was going to do and I'll become king, right? And I'm hoping for that now, but also I'm going to trust even though I don't see it. I don't see it. I'm going to trust that God is at work even if I can't see what he's doing. As we close out this morning, reflecting on this thought and idea of that God is always at work. God's at work. And the story of David shows us that God's at work. The fact that David exists as a king is because God is at work. He's doing something. Even when we don't see it, he's at work. And David chose to be a person that trusted in that. Trusted in that. I don't see it right now. I can't fathom how, you know, I'm hiding in a cave. They're going to kill me. But no, God, I know you're at work. I don't need to kill Saul. I don't need to do that. God's at work. We'll get there. We'll get there. But it'll be in God's timing, not my own. So I want to reflect on a few things. God is at work everywhere, all the time. God is at work everywhere, all the time. And he wants to partner with you through Jesus to bring his kingdom here on earth. You remember Jesus' prayer. Teach us how to pray. Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. The launching pad for our prayers is a prayer that says, God, bring your rule, your reign, your kingdom here on earth. This is what we're to pray. That God wants to use us to make this happen. So there are two kinds of prayer I'm going to ask you to pray this week. I want you to pray this prayer every week. Every morning when you get up, I want you to pray this prayer. So if you have to write this down somewhere, take your notes, pin it up on your mirror, write it on your mirror in the morning and something. Like, I don't care what you do, but this is what I want you to pray. And I'm serious when I say this. I actually want you to pray this every single day this week. God, give me the eyes to see what you're up to around me. God, give me the courage to step into that reality at the proper time. God, give me eyes to see what you're doing with my coworkers, with my siblings, with my parents, with my friends. God, help me to see what you're doing. Give me eyes to see that, Lord. Help me just for a minute see what you're up to. And then when you show me something, which often looks like an opportunity, y'all. That's how God works. Him revealing something to you often comes in the form of an opportunity. And then we got to pray, God, give me the courage to step into that. One quick story. A few years ago, my neighbor across the street, his father died. And I knew because I saw ambulances and all these things. So the next day I saw him out on the street, he was getting the mail, and my heart stirred to go and talk to him. So I went out and I just, hey, you know, I'm so sorry for your loss. If there's anything we can do, you know, we hadn't really talked very much, seen him here and there, so no real relationship there. But hey, you know, just want to say I'm sorry. Here for you guys, you know, if you need any food or anything, Jane and I are happy to help out. You need help around the house, let us know. And the whole time I'm talking, he's like, thank you, thank you. The whole time I'm talking, I hear in my head, pray for him, pray for him, pray for him. And my heart's racing, pray for him, pray for him. And I'm talking, if we're here for you, if you need, pray for him, pray for him. Okay, thank you. And I walk away. I didn't pray for him. And I got in the house, and my heart sank. And I turned around to think, maybe I can, and he was already inside his house. God gave me an opportunity to see what he was doing. I did not have the courage to step into it. Your prayer this week, God, help me to see what you're up to, which will come in the form of an opportunity, most likely. And God, give me the courage, because it takes that, doesn't it, to step into that. Give me that courage. That's your prayer this week. As we get ready for communion, hopefully you grab some on your way your way in, I want us to take a minute to just reflect on this challenge. What is God inviting you into? What part of the story? You're on deck, right? The heroes of our faith have done their part. We're on deck now. We're ready. God's calling us up the bat. How are we going to be a part of his story? What is he inviting us into? Do we have courage to do that? I want us to sit and wrestle with that just for a few moments, then we'll take communion together. So let's reflect on this challenge.